Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 16 of Mic Check on Sports. I'm Steve Napolitani. Continuing off of episode 15, where we mentioned some small businesses to support, I wanted to keep going with some former guests. John Gino wanted to give a mention to Bway Cafe in Hoboken, New Jersey. Eddie Olchek supports the Red Rooster in Arlington Heights, Illinois, and the Stony River Restaurant in Deer Park, Illinois. Shep Messing mentions the Wellground, a lifestyle brand in Port Washington, Long Island. And I would like to dedicate this episode to Court Street Restaurant in Hoboken, New Jersey. My next guest has been synonymous with New York sports for over 40 years. He is known for one of the most famous calls in New York Rangers history, and he has quickly become the hottest new account on Twitter. It's Mets broadcaster Howie Rose. Howie, how are you?
Funny. Thanks, Steve. It's amazing how people bring that up now.
So let's get right to the Twitter thing. Yeah. What made you do it?
At first, boredom, you know, just going through what we're all going through right now. I've been prodded to do it by people for years, but I never trusted myself because, you know, I've just always been afraid that I would lean on the more liberal or, you know, gambling side of sending a tweet, and then the second that goes out going, that wasn't a very good idea. So it was just, you know, it wasn't a matter of not really wanting to do it as much as just not trusting myself. But, you know, I'm a little older and more mature now than I was when Twitter started, so I kind of feel like I've adapted to that part of it. And then the other thing, and really the overriding thing, is just missing the connection with the fans, because you know, spring training is just what it is. It just kind of drags on after a while, and you want to get those games over with because they're not a lot of fun to broadcast, really. You don't know half the players in the game after about the third or fourth inning. But, you know, on March 26th, when I woke up and it was supposed to be opening day and I should have been at Citi Field, that's when I really felt, oh, man, this is not right. And so just, you know, to stay connected to the people with whom I think all of the Mets broadcasters have this almost umbilical connection to is very important for me. And it's been a great sort of catharsis to be on Twitter.
Well, now I know you're close friends with Joe Micheletti.
Yeah, I spoke to him yesterday.
You got to get him on Twitter. That's the next goal.
That might be a project, too.
Yeah, that is a project.
But CJ, you know, like, Joe's never going to get into trouble. He's too smart. You know, I'm a bit of a blockhead when it comes to some of that stuff. I sometimes lean too heavily on the Freudian id, and then you realize that, well, maybe you shouldn't. It'd be easy for Joe if he wants to.
And so what are you doing with all your free time now, other than Twitter?
Well, I'm blessed to be in Florida, where we live, other than during baseball season. So it's advantageous to have the weather that we do down here. The weather's largely been spectacular. And so I've been able to, at the very least, go on a nice long bike ride every day, get a great workout doing that. I live in a community that has three golf courses. We're not back to playing yet. Hopefully we'll be soon, but we have the ability to walk those courses and just enjoy the greenery, the scenery, or just laying out in the backyard reading. And I love to read. And so this has been a great time to catch up on some books or authors or just read for the sake of passing some time. And so I've been able to fill some time, but there's just no getting around the fact that there's a huge void right now. And I just can't wait to get back to baseball.
And I heard you were a little ahead of your time in terms of keeping things sanitized. I heard a story years ago in Boston, somebody asking you if you had Purell, and you pulled it right out.
Well, because the thing is, see, those guys, and, you know, let's name who we're talking about here. Larry Roth, the Rangers director, who for so many years was the director on the Islander shows and a better guy. He's a great director and an even better guy, and I just miss him and our former producer Kevin Meininger terribly. But we became pretty close as traveling companions, and I've just always been a bit of a germaphobe, really. So yeah, I was ahead of my time on the whole Purell thing, you know. And we had dinner one night in Boston, and we're walking down Hanover Street where all the restaurants and Mike's Pastry and everything else is. And a couple of women come by and says, does anybody have any hand sanitizer? And I just looked at them and they looked at me. I mean, I say them, meaning Kevin and Larry. They go, oh, no, you got to be kidding. I said, well, I just happen to have something here. And I said, see, guys, it's, you know, if I were younger and single, this stuff is a magnet, you know. We were missing out on all that.
That's funny. Oh, boy. So, you know, you're born in Brooklyn, New York. What was your childhood like?
Oh, I'd say pretty normal. Not much different from any, I think, average kid growing up in a middle to lower middle class area. We got out of Brooklyn when I was 5. I actually went to the Bronx for a couple of years and then settled in Bayside, Queens when I was 8. And so I consider Bayside very much to have been my hometown. Brooklyn and the Bronx were a bit of a blur. Mm-hmm. But Bayside, to me, was idyllic. I mean, I went from neighborhoods that had big apartment buildings and, you know, a lot of population density, everybody within a very close proximity to each other. And, you know, in those days, people didn't, as they say, curb their dogs the way they should. And I think I learned to dance a little bit walking through the streets of the Bronx, just trying to step around on the, you know, the dog droppings. But, you know, getting to Bayside, Queens, growing up in a garden apartment with grass and playgrounds, and it was just a completely different experience. And the couple of kids I had been in touch with in second grade when I moved from the Bronx to Bayside, I said to them, hey, I moved to the country. and that's frankly what Bayside, Queens felt like back then. So it was as idyllic an upbringing and setting as I think under middle to lower middle class circumstances anyone could hope for.
And were you always, was sports always a part of your life?
Yeah, you know, my dad introduced me to baseball in, of all years, 1961, when I was 7 years old. And 1961 was the year that not only did the Yankees have one of the greatest teams in their history, but Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle took dead aim at Babe Ruth's home run record of 60 in a season, which, of course, Maris broke on the last day of the year. And imagine being impressionable and wide-eyed at baseball and sitting in Yankee Stadium with your dad at 7 years old, having him teach the game to you while some of the greatest players in the history of the sport are performing right in front of you. Roger Maris was my first hero. I took to him a little more so than Mantle back then because Maris was left-handed and I'm left-handed. And of course, Mickey was a switch hitter. But over the years of my adolescence, I guess, when I started playing Little League, it was just incredible how all of us, and this is in Queens in 1964, 65, 66, you know, we all had perfectly healthy legs and knees, but we all ran like Mickey Mantle, you know, with that almost, if you remember the character actor in The Real McCoys, Walter Brennan, the way he, you know, he would move with his shoulders hunched, and it was so painful sometimes to watch Mickey run, but we all ran like that. We were all perfectly fine, but we all ran like we were on our last legs.
And then broadcasting, was that something you always wanted to get into? Was that where you kind of, at a young age, see your future?
Yeah, you know, when I reflect on it as far back, believe it or not, as when I was 3, 4, 5 years old, I always really found a certain fascination in anybody who wore a microphone, game show hosts or newscasters, but especially back then, game show hosts, because they walked around with a microphone, a long, narrow, cylinder-shaped object draped around their neck. I'm talking about talk show hosts, and you probably remember some of the later ones like the great Gene Rayburn, but before him came Bud Collier and some others, and Bud was a favorite. He hosted a show called Beat the Clock, which was a game show, and then To Tell the Truth. But anyway, I don't know what it was, but something really appealed to me about wearing that microphone. And so back in those days, as young as I was, my dad got a Polaroid camera. And the film for that Polaroid was attached to a spool that was much shorter, but somewhat, in a vague way, similarly shaped to those microphones I just described. Well, my mom would tie a string around that spool when the film ran out. I'd wear it around my neck and just walk around interviewing people in the street. You know, hi, what's your name? You know, stuff. So I kind of knew that I had a fascination with broadcasting, which, you know, manifested step by step through a passion for sports and then sports announcing and all the way to today, really. I'm no less passionate about it now than I was then.
And was there some sports broadcasters you kind of looked up at?
Well, my very, very first sort of broadcasting idol was Mel Allen, going back again to 1961. He was the first autograph I ever got. my dad and I were at a game at Yankee Stadium, and we happened to be seated in the old mezzanine, which didn't have that many rows, and it was seated behind that sort of one-row press and broadcast area, so that if you needed to go to the bathroom and you were Mel Allen, for instance, you had to walk through the crowd and go to a common bathroom that the fans used. And so he's walking up the aisle, and my dad sees him and says, "Hey, there's Mel Allen. Why don't you go get his autograph?" And I had no idea what that word even meant. I said, "What do I do?" He said, here's the scorecard. Here's the pen or pencil. He says, "Just say, 'Mr. Allen, may I please have your autograph?' Give him the program, and he'll do the rest." I said, "Okay." So I did that, went back to the seat, and I was a little disappointed and a little afraid to face my dad because he said, "Well, did you get the autograph?" I said, "Well, I think so." I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, didn't you ask him?" I said, "Yeah, but all he did was write his name." I'd never heard of an autograph. I knew the word photograph. Right. Maybe I thought he was going to draw a picture of himself or something. But that was my first autograph, Mel Allen. And then later on, when I discovered hockey and the Rangers, Marv Albert was just the one for me. And later, you know, became president of his fan club in 1967. And frankly, I still am. And he was the biggest influence on my career.
Wow. And then also growing up in your youth, it just recently read that it was an Earth Day, and you skipped Earth Day and went to watch Tom Seaver's historic game where he struck out the final 10 batters.
Yeah. I mean, the decision between Earth Day and going to see, at that time, the world champion Mets with Tom Seaver on the mound, I mean, that was as much of a mismatch as Seaver was for the Padres that day. Earth Day, my foot, Seaver's pitching, let's go.
Right.
And it was, you know, an apocalyptic game in the Mets history, if not baseball history. Because no one struck out 10 in a row since.
Right. And you attended Queens College, and then you worked at Sports Phone, which in my house growing up was number 10 on the speed dial.
Oh, you remember that one?
Oh, yeah. And so it seemed like that was a launching pad for so many sportscasters, but you seem to be one of the earlier guys in, right?
Yeah, so much so that there was this kid that used to call and answer all the quickie quizzes. I think his name was Kenneth Albert. seriously, I mean, yeah, you know, yeah. Kenny answered a lot of the old quickie quiz questions. And let's see, I know that Gary Cohen, Al Troutwig, Michael Kay,
John Giannone, Don McGricka.
I mean, so many others. Right. I mean, I would love to have some kind of reunion. That started in 75. There was an aborted attempt 2 years earlier that never took. But in 75, they got the proper funding, and the timing was right, and it was run by the right people. Program or a company known as Airtime those days, which was a media buying service, but they had the right guys behind it. Fred Weiner and Bruce Fogel, I think, were their names, and they gave it the support financially that it needed, and that got a lot of our career started. Absolutely love to have a reunion. When we 75 is when it started, so we're still 5 years away, but that'd be a neat 50th anniversary reunion.
That would be a who's who of broadcasters for sure. And then you went and did updates for CBS Radio. And then in 1987, you became the original primetime host when WFAN launched in 1987. Was that a big moment for you?
Oh, my God. It was career altering, really, because I had been at WHN Radio from 1977 through 1983, and then worked for a few years at WCBS Radio and some other places, including as a fill-in play-by-play guy for Marv on the Rangers. So that got my hockey career going. But before WFAN, which was at 1050 on the AM dial back then, was a station named WHN, a longtime country music station in New York, and they were going to change to an all-sports format. I had been hired by HN to do, and really by the Mets, to do their extended pre- and post-game shows called Mets Extra, which I was very proud of because we broke some ground on those shows. But anyway, we eventually went from being WHN to WFAN, and I was kept on as not only the Mets pre- and post-game guy, but also the 7 to midnight in those days general sports talk show host. So, I mean, that was a real sort of turning point for me in my career, because it enabled me to sort of display a number of different skills that you don't get when you're just reading scores in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Was it a different atmosphere for you to try and be in the studio for that kind of long form segments?
Well, it was exciting because I had never done a telephone talk show before. And although there had been some successful sports talk shows in the city, they were one-offs. You know, back in the day, you had Bill Mazur. Before him, you had Marty Glickman. And, you know, later came Art Russ Jr. And Dave Sims and, you know, a couple of others, John Sterling, Jack Spector. But they were never part of an all-sports format. So I always looked at it that in the early days of WFAN, we were pioneers akin to what those who were doing live television at the inception of TV were. You know, we were kind of making it up formatically as we went along. It wasn't just about doing a 2 or 3 hour show. It was about programming it for most of an entire day. And so we did feel like pioneers. Mm-hmm. That was exciting. But I always wanted more than anything to do play-by-play. So when the opportunity came to do that full-time later on, it wasn't a very hard decision for me to make.
Right. And early on in your career, you mentioned doing some Ranger games. And everyone knows the Stephon Matteau double OT goal versus the Devils in Game 7 of the 94 Eastern Conference Finals. One of your most famous calls. Did you ever think it would become what it has become?
Well, I'll answer that in a couple of ways, Steve. First off, it wouldn't have become what it has if the Rangers didn't go on to win the Cup. I think that's a very important point that's too often overlooked when people, you know, like to talk about how much they enjoyed that call. Yeah, it was great, but if the Rangers had lost the final, then I don't know that it would have received as much airplay or discussion as it has over the years. So, you know, it was inextricably linked to an even greater moment for the Rangers. But to have had that moment, you know, remains a thrill to this day, almost 26 years to the day. It's going to be May 27th before you know it, and that's going to be 26 years to the day. And the fact that it's endured the way it has is something I'm very, very proud of, because as someone who had to try to subjugate his rooting interests for the sake of providing a fair and accurate play-by-play, there was a lot of pent-up emotion that was released when that puck went into the net. And so that's why I heard myself lose it in a manner that I never had before or since. And whereas I was a little uncomfortable in the moment just because of that, having not sort of heard myself that way, I'm a lot more comfortable with it now, all these years later.
Was there any part of it that was the Mount Vancouver part? Did you have that in your mind beforehand, or that just...
No.
That
was I'll tell you what, I had one small thing in mind, because as you know, the Devils tied that game with 7.7 seconds left in regulation time, which, I mean, that was, look, the Rangers had lost some bad games in their playoff history, never mind regular season history. And they'd been through every manner of pain and frustration in their playoff existence. But that, with 7.7 seconds left, when you're that close to the final, that was cruel and unusual punishment. That was beyond anybody's comprehension. And so, you know, when you talk about how things transpired, the only thing that I had planned just before Zalapukin scored, and I didn't think about this until we got into the final minute, was, okay, how do you want to play this now, assuming the clock just runs out? Mm-hmm. Let's just punctuate the final buzzer, say something succinct, and that was going to be, and now there's one more hill to climb, boom, and let the crowd carry it, only for the few seconds that you really have the ability to on radio before you've got to get back on and explain what's happening. But that was my only plan. It was just going to be, and again, I didn't think of that until the last minute, and I was afraid to even articulate it in my mind, probably for superstitious reasons. Right. So naturally, what happens, just as I'm all set to go, and now there's one more hill to climb, boom, Zalapukin drops the big one. And, you know, after that, I had no conviction that they were going to win that game because they just never won a game like that.
Wow. And, it, you know, last year we celebrated at the Garden, and, you know, that special with Stephon Matteau too. So, and even just before this, I told a friend that, you know, I was going to speak with you, and he just wrote back, Matteau. That was his only response.
You wouldn't believe how much of that I even get at Citi Field or other cities at baseball games now. And again, it's I guess it's part of my history, and I'm very proud of it. So, Matteau yourself crazy if you want.
And then in 1995, you full time with the Mets, doing baseball.
Well, yeah. Let me see. Let me back that up. Not exactly. What happened was, you know, I was still doing the pre and post for the Mets and my talk show at WFAN and the Rangers on radio. But one big caveat, I was not doing all of the Rangers games on radio because, you know, it was Marv's gig, but he still did, I don't know, 20, 25 games a year. And, you know, it was great for me to be able to establish myself as a New York play-by-play guy doing the 55, 60 games, plus however many playoff games I did. But, you know, it was never mine. And I needed at that point in my career to find something that was just going to be mine. And, I mean, I never asked Marv how long he was planning on staying. I took that job with the absolute understanding that, you know, it's Marv's until he walks away from it, and then you'd be in position. And along the way, the people at the Garden within the network hierarchy, you know, would say that if the Rangers ever won the cup, that's when they figured Marv would leave, but they won the cup and he didn't. So I said, okay, well, then he's going to be here indefinitely, and I've got to look out for myself in terms of should another opportunity come up. Well, the summer of 75, pardon me, the summer of 95, that opportunity did come up when I learned through the grapevine, the broadcast grapevine, that Jiggs McDonald was not going to be back with the Islanders. And I got on the horn with my agent right away and said, get that. You know, that's what I've been looking for. And, it served a couple of purposes. Initially, not only to give me my own, you know, team to be around from start to finish, but also to, you know, make the transition from radio to television. Not that I didn't like or don't like radio. I love it. In fact, it's my preferred medium. But you get to a point in your career where you've got to make career moves. And at that point, the opportunity to get into television and have an NHL job that was all mine was an absolute no-brainer. So in the summer of 95, I took that job with what was then Sports Channel. And I think it, if I recall properly, was to do the Islanders, meaning the deal was to do the Islanders. And then I think we had something written in there for like 60 other shows or events with a sort of tacit understanding that it would involve the Mets on some level. We didn't know what. And then along the way, after the 95 baseball season, Rusty Staub left the broadcast booth, and then the Mets and Sports Channel came to me and asked if I would like to do that package as well, which, you know, was going to complicate things because, you know, now I'd be doing half a baseball schedule, but a year later it became, you know, more than half and a full hockey schedule. And so that became difficult logistically, but you don't turn those jobs down. And
so there's only so many.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's kind of how that segue and transition took place.
And then I did read in 2004 that you almost quit the Mets. What happened there?
Well, what happened was most of the time that I'd been doing TV, and again, it wasn't on a full-time basis for the Mets, you know, I would get some sort of signal, and usually it was a pretty direct verbal one from someone in the Mets hierarchy, that sooner or later, we got to make plans for when Bob Murphy retires because it's coming. We don't know if it's this year, next, the year after. But just keep in the back of your mind that that might be a nice landing spot for you. And I was told that it has the support of ownership. And, you know, I'm no dummy. I knew what they were telling me there, that, you know, if I wanted it when Murph stepped down, that's what they wanted to do, take me off of television and put me on radio full time. Well, you know, I had mixed emotions about that for a lot of reasons, not the least, and in fact, the greatest of which was that now that meant I was going to be doing a full hockey schedule with the Islanders and then a full radio baseball schedule with the Mets. And that just seemed untenable. You know, I remember there were a lot of people within that building, meaning MSG, who now own the rights to the Islanders and the Mets, who said, you're not going to be able to do that. It's an untenable schedule.
Well, I can't even imagine it.
Yeah, well, I can't either now as I look back. But, you know, you make decisions for a lot of reasons. And some of us do it, frankly, in this business for ego reasons. And that enters into it or entered into that decision a little bit. But for me, it became, okay, I was still relatively young at the time. I was 50, and my kids were way too young for me to be thinking about just doing one and having an off season like a normal person. Mm-hmm. You know, my thing was, how can I provide for them the best that I can? And another way of saying that is, how can I maximize my income?
Right.
And so that was obviously going to enable me to do that, but it was not without a lot of trepidation. And so I took it, and I remember Kevin Meininger telling me in Montreal, we had been in Montreal for a game against the Canadiens with the Islanders, and we went out to dinner the night before, as we always did. And that's one of the things I miss more than anything about Kevin and Larry, are those dinners we had the night before. And of course, Joe, and you know from traveling with them just what great guys they are. But anyway, I remember having some misgivings about how my schedule was going to play out. And, you know, I wasn't thrilled about giving up doing baseball on TV to go exclusively to radio. But, you know, Kevin said to me over dinner, he said, look, you know, Bob Murphy wasn't happy when they took him off TV in 82, but it became the greatest thing that ever happened to him, because that kind of, you know, it gave his career a completely sort of different texture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to potentially work out the same for you. So, you know, just feel good about this. It's a, you know, these things don't grow on trees. So anyway, I said, yeah, you're right. I took the job, but we had just finished an Islander playoff series. I think they were in they lost to Tampa Bay. And I know I had to get back and do a game the very next day. And then we were going on the road. And we were in L.A. I remember this very, very clearly. Mm-hmm. We were in L.A. staying at the old Century Plaza Hotel. Mm-hmm. And I'm on the treadmill. This is right after the Islander series ended, right after I had to fly to New York, do a game with the Mets Saturday and Sunday, I think it was, and then make a cross-country trip to L.A. So I'm on the treadmill in the fitness room in that hotel in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And honest to goodness, for about 60 seconds of my workout, I was leaving the Mets. I said to myself, I can't do this. I can't do it. I said, what am I going to do? I said, I've got no life. This is just insane. I said, look, you know, Gary's the lead guy right now. They won't miss me. They'll get somebody else to work with Gary. And I think I'll go to a travel agent right after I work out. I'll fly home to New York today. You know, I'll send them a Dear John letter, and that'll be it. And I'll just do the Islanders and hopefully live happily ever after. But I can't do this. And I'm being completely honest and forthright about this. I had this vision of my late dad, who is the one who turned me on to baseball. And it's not like there was this, you know, clear dialogue that took place. Right. I saw this abstract image of my father essentially saying, you are not giving up a Major League Baseball job for the team of your youth. Suck it up and get back to work. I mean, that basically was the message I took from that vision, which is all it was that I had of my dad.
Right.
And that was at the end of probably 60 seconds or so. But for that 1 minute, I was leaving the Mets.
Wow. Wow. And then, you know, you have all those years with the Islanders, and then following the 15-16 season, you decide, you know what, I'm going to step away from the Islanders telecast. How difficult was that decision?
Very, very difficult. But at the same time, it was time.
Right.
My daughters were now out of college, and I really stayed on a year or two longer than I should have, because I don't think I delivered the product personally on the air, certainly not in terms of preparation anyway, that I had done earlier in my career with the Islanders. I really cut a lot of corners, but it was the only way that I could survive doing both sports full time those last couple of years with the Islanders. See, by then, morning skates were now all online.
Right.
And everybody knew I hated the morning skate to begin with. It was, you know, my feeling was like Wilt Chamberlain's when they put the morning shoot around in the NBA in the late 60s, and his coach, Butch Van Bredekoff, told him, okay, we're having a morning shoot around and then the game at night. And Chamberlain said to him, hey, coach, you got me once a day. You want me in the morning or at night? Your choice. And that's kind of where I came to be as far as the morning skate was concerned. So, you know, cutting that out, as I say, cut some corners, enabled me to get a good night's sleep, and, and put all my energy into doing the game. But again, my preparation wasn't what it used to be. And I just had to do it that way or I had no chance.
Right.
And so, yeah, when we got into that, and then, you know, the last straw was Brooklyn. I mean, I just wanted no part of that move to Brooklyn. I don't want to, say I was prescient, because I think anybody with a little bit of vision could have seen that that was never going to work for a million reasons. And it didn't. And so that last year in Brooklyn was very, very difficult for me. I just didn't have my head into it at all. And so when the Islanders beat the Florida Panthers on the John Tavares second overtime goal to win the series, I knew 95% that was it. I just needed a couple of weeks to clear my head and make sure I was going to make the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very melancholy sort of emotional night for me, because it was such a great night for the Islanders and their fans who had waited 23 years to win a playoff series. And then that's my last hockey call I've ever made. And so it's a great way to go out, but I still miss it terribly.
And when you look back on your Islander days, what comes to mind? What do you remember?
You know, there are a lot of things, right, and just about all of them are good. I still say, and I know I alluded to this a few minutes ago, nothing was more fun than those dinners the night before a game on the road. I mean, we just had a ball. And, you know, I've been blessed that just about everybody I've worked with in this business I've either at minimum gotten along with or just really enjoyed their company. And the relationship that Kevin and Larry and Joe Micheletti and Charlie Kuchera and some of the others who, you know, work with us not as a revolving door, but just, with several changes over the years. I mean, those dinners were just great. And then, as I say, I was blessed with fabulous analysts all the way from Eddie Westfall to Joe, to Billy Jaffe, and then Butch Goring. You couldn't ask for more. So on the broadcast side of it, it was nirvana. And, you know, the games, when the Coliseum was full and the Islanders were good, and sadly they weren't really good for that many years that I was there. But, I mean, from 2001, 2002, the 2000, I guess it would have been 13 playoffs, but 01, 02, 2013, and then the last year at the Coliseum, oh my goodness, that place absolutely rock. And I get goosebumps thinking about some of those games, and the memories are just so vivid and so wonderful, and it's impossible not to miss it, because I do.
And now, of course, all the games on the radio and your signature call after a Mets win, put it in the books. Where did that phrase come from?
The schoolyard, basically.
Yeah.
Or the streets. I mean, being a street urchin as I was, it was something that we would occasionally say we're playing in a schoolyard basketball game and, you know, my team won, or I was playing stickball and I won, or if my buddies and I were at Shea Stadium sitting in the upper deck and the Mets won. And at the end of a winning game, we'd have some generic variation of that by saying, and not every time, but just occasionally, well, that one's in the books. Mm-hmm. But it was never put it in the books. The motivation for put it in the books came from, and he didn't even know it until I told him, nor should he have known it, was Marty Brenneman, the Hall of Fame recently retired broadcaster for the Cincinnati Reds. Marty ends his winning Reds broadcasts by saying, and it's perfect, and this one belongs to the Reds. And so on the third out, or, you know, they score the winning run in the bottom of the ninth or whatever inning, as soon as the game ends, Reds win, Marty's call is, and this one belongs to the Reds. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, you can't, I mean, that is just perfect. It's succinct. It's not self-aggrandizing. It tells the listener immediately that the Reds have won.
Mm-hmm.
Man, would I like to come up with something like that. And so that's when the whole it's in the books thing came into my head. And, you know, I fumbled around with various inflections until I came to what is now the one that I use. And yeah, I mean, that's sort of taken on a life of its own, too. And again, it's something I'm very proud of.
And I recently saw a promo, I believe it was last year, with your daughter, where you were having some fun about, oh, we put it on the books. Now we got to change. I got to try a different approach. Maybe I'll send it to the cloud. Whose idea was that promo? Was that
That was a wonderful idea coming from a couple of people who work in social media and game presentation with the Mets, Joe DeVito and Will Carafello and Vito Vidiello. I mean, they all thought this something like this could really work well. And Melissa, who is a social media correspondent for the Mets, my daughter, you know, she handles that stuff perfectly because she's got a stage background. She's been an actress and, you know, she's done some television work here and there, little bits and pieces. And so she's very comfortable in front of the camera. And she made it flow, even if it was just with some facial expressions or one or two lines. But that was a wonderful spot. I love that one.
That was great. If those who haven't seen it, you have to Google it. It's awesome. So funny. And then in November, you were most recently inducted into the New York Sports Hall of Fame. How much of an honor was that?
Well, look at it this way. Anytime you are asked to accept entry into an establishment that houses the likes of Sandy Koufax, Mickey Mantle, members of my beloved 1969 Mets, and Vin Scully, and you know, so many other great luminaries. It's humbling. It's an honor. And I was really, really thrilled that I was down in Florida by then. So the ceremonies were in Troy, New York, just outside Albany. It was just going to be my wife and I who were going to fly up for it. I told my daughter, look, there's no need for you to drive 3 hours. So, look, I appreciate you even thinking about it, but you guys don't need to drive up and drive back. That's a tough trip. Mm-hmm. Thanks, but, you know, stay home. And that's the way it was going to be. And then not long before we left the hotel room to go downstairs to the dinner and ceremonies, get a knock on the door, and it's my daughter's. Oh. And I mean, that just made the whole thing. It was just a magical, magical event. And to have Barbara and both Alyssa and Chelsea there just made it that much more special.
You've had such an amazing career. And a lot of people I talk to, you know, they'll say, you know, I wish I took the time to look at it. Do you ever just sit at Citi Field, look out there and think about the career you've had and kind of put a smile on your face?
Well, I've always been introspective. I just am by nature. So I've never really let a day go by when I don't consciously appreciate the good fortune that I've had in the business and the incredible ride that I've had with the Mets, just thinking about what the odds must have been against it, you know, right. Being a kid in the schoolyard at PS 205 in Bayside, you know, who would have Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, and Ralph Kiner in his eyes and ears every day for 6 months, to eventually not only ascend to a role on the Mets broadcast team, but actually to have worked with two of them, with Bob and Ralph. Lindsey had left the Mets well before I got there, but you know, I mean, to have worked with Bob and Ralph, mm-hmm. the odds against that were astronomical. Right. But what I do is take a glance once or twice if the situation requires it. We've got a picture, a big frame picture in our Bob Murphy broadcast booth at Citi Field of those three iconic Mets announcers, Lindsey, Bob, and Ralph. And it's over my right shoulder. And so if there's a game, maybe it's in a lost season, maybe it's just a game that's dragging, maybe it's a one-sided game, the kind of game where you ordinarily look at your watch or the clock and go, come on, it's another game tomorrow, let's just move on from this one. Mm-hmm. When I start feeling like the adrenaline is oozing out and maybe my emotions aren't idling at the speed they're supposed to, I just steal a look over at that picture, and that immediately recalibrates me and performs an instant reset. And if I ever needed to be reminded of how fortunate I was even to be doing a bad game in a lost season on a cold night or whatever, you're just looking at those three up on the wall in that booth, that resets me immediately.
That's great. And when the 2020 baseball season does hopefully happen, What do you see for the Mets?
Well, look, obviously you go back to what kind of shape they were in before the lockdown came. Well, they knew that Michael Conforto was going to miss a little bit of time. because he had strained his oblique, and that certainly shouldn't be an issue by the time they get back to playing, whenever that is. But it wasn't until after the exhibition game stopped that we learned that Noah Syndergaard needed Tommy John surgery. Mm. That's a pretty big hit.
Right.
You know, that's your number two horse in a rotation that features one of the all-time great Mets pitchers now, Jacob DeGrom. So anytime you take Syndergaard out of that rotation, you've weakened it. Mm-hmm. And it remains to be seen, particularly, and I think this is important, whenever they get back, they're going to squeeze as many games in as they can. And so the schedule, much as it was in the NHL after a couple of lockout seasons that resumed midway through what would have mm-hmm. been the, you know, initial schedule, you know, you remember those schedules were compressed, and right. there were a lot of games squeezed into a relatively few days. And so that's going to happen with baseball, and you're going to need depth on your pitching staff. And to lose a Syndergaard really gives that depth a big hit. And so that's going to be an initial challenge. But it's certainly a team that, at least on paper before that injury, looked as though they could certainly compete perhaps for a division title, if not a wild card. But we don't even know what the format's going to be because there were so many plans right. being discussed. It doesn't even make sense to speculate too much until we know when and where even under what format these games are going to be played. But please, let's play them.
Oh, we need it more than ever. You know, as I watch this last dance that's talked about in the Chicago Bulls on ESPN, it's just proof that we need sports back.
Oh,
so much.
Can you believe that? Can you believe, I mean, a documentary became must-watch television for an entire country.
It's you know? Absolutely, the numbers and the amount of advertisers for the NFL draft and that people never advertised in the NFL draft before. There was like 60 new sponsors just because.
And wasn't it great the way they pulled it off? I mean, it was so challenging on so many levels. And, you know, you're as well versed on television as anyone, and probably more so than me. But just to see how relatively without, it was seamless.
Right. I mean, it was absolutely remarkable.
To pull that off in multiple sites with the reaction shots that they had and the way they did and to see the way some of these guys were working, I just thought it was an absolutely phenomenally produced and executed product. And, you know, this is my only concern about going on Twitter. You know, the thought that Dave Gettleman, a cancer survivor, would be criticized for, yeah, sometimes he wasn't wearing it, at other times he was, for having a mask right. in his own home when he, you know, clearly there were other people there who had to get him set up, and he's in a vulnerable position because of his medical history. How anyone could have criticized him for that
right.
is beyond my ability to even understand. But at the end of the day, it just was a marvelously produced package that really included some cinema verite, and I just thought it was great.
I thought it was great too. I actually thought it was better than years before.
Yep.
And before I let you go, Howie, you know, I like to mention a small business during this time that, you know, everybody likes to kind of support. Is there one by you that you support?
Well, here in Florida, you know, where I live, it's a matter of local businesses, restaurants. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody can sit inside a restaurant and have dinner now, but we still have to support these people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think, first of all, I just, when I go into Publix, the supermarket down here, or any of the other markets where we're able to get food, you know, I look at these people who day after day under these adverse, sometimes frightening conditions are coming in to do their jobs to make sure that all of us have food on the table and all the things that we need to get by. I salute every one of them. I don't know their names, of course, but mm-hmm. anybody who's working right now is certainly worthy of a major salute. But I'm just thinking of little, you know, restaurants or places that we support here, whether it's PA Ribs in the Gardens Mall or Giovanni's down North Lake Boulevard, or just really any of the other places where you've got an opportunity, whether it's Joseph's Market or Carmine's Market. These are the little places, the small businesses that are staying open and, you know, and taking a lot of risks so that we can get on with our lives as best we can under these circumstances. And I thank and salute every one of them, as well as everybody around the country who have pitched in on any level to keep us up and running as best we can.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you pitching in and coming on to the podcast, and I appreciate your time, and I can't wait to hopefully listen to you very soon. calling Mets games. And thanks for coming on, Howie.
My pleasure, Steve. Be well.
Well, you can put that interview in the books. Talk about living out a dream. Howie Rose has done that. Can't wait to hear his voice again calling Mets games. On the next episode of Mike Check on Sports, I will chat with the voice of the J-E-T-S Jets, Bob Wischusen. Take care. Brush your hair.